of your neighbor is a measure of your worth. Can you hear a baby if she cries out in the ghetto? And if you do, is she within your reach?
Welcome to Reach to Touch, brought to you in part by ChuckHancock.com, MaryJaneHolt.com, and TheJesseLeeJonesStory.com.
Is a measure of your worth. Can you hear a baby if she cries out in the ghetto? And if you do, is she within your reach?
Gotta give thanks to Scott Rowley for letting us use his amazing song, Within My Reach, here at Reach to Touch. Well, guys, I am here today, and I am literally in his presence. We are not on the telephone, and I love it when I'm talking to people eyeball to eyeball. I'm with David W. Richardson, Jr., and I think they call him Dave.
They call me Dave.
He's written a book called Transparent. I was so intrigued when I got an email from his publicist by just the title. Then she told me that he used to be with Campus Crusade for Christ. And she told me that he has an institute called Assumptions Institute.
Yes, the Assumptions Institute.
Okay, so y'all know me well enough to know by now that I was curious. So curious that I made a date with Dave, and we're about to talk about who he is, where he comes from, where he got the title Transparent, why he even wrote the book, and what is the Assumptions Institute. So who are you?
Well, I am an interesting guy. I grew up in a small farm town in northwestern Oregon, small town, rural life, all of that. My dad was a truck driver for many years, lived in a single wide trailer house, just a regular guy, but happened to be given a gift and an opportunity to use it. I have more than just your average interest in apologetics and academic kinds of things. When I was a college student, I actually started the Campus Crusade Ministry at my university, the University of Portland in Portland, Oregon. And that ministry was student-led, had some staff that were giving input to it. But 35 years later, that ministry still exists and is still run by students.
What were you studying? What were you yourself studying?
Well, actually, my degree at University of Portland was an interdisciplinary degree. I couldn't settle on a major, so I had four minors. And I studied theology. I studied music. I studied business administration. And I also studied electrical engineering. So I have an eclectic, broad interest in lots of different things. And that has really been how I've been oriented all my life. I'm interested in lots of things. Rather than being a specialist in one thing, I have this ability to have a conversation with people in a variety of different areas. And I ended up pursuing full-time ministry with Campus Crusade. I served for 30 years on their staff. And 20 of those years, I worked with a very unique ministry called Faculty Commons. And that
say that again.
Faculty Commons.
C-O-M-M-O-N-S.
Yes.
Okay.
And that is Crew's ministry to college professors. Now, everybody knows of Campus Crusade as a college student ministry, and that's how it started. But in 1980, they started a new division with a couple of crazy people that thought they could pull it off, and they did, starting a ministry to college professors.
What colleges?
Colleges all over the United States, major university campuses. I mean, I've got colleagues at the University of Texas, at Harvard, at the Ohio State University, at University of Washington, at UCLA, and myself. I've worked here in the Atlanta area at Georgia Tech. Well, one of the things we were trying to do is help those who are Christian professors to be an effective ambassador for Christ on the campus, rather than a hired gun coming onto the campus and trying to make a difference, which is still important to do.
Do we still have Christian professors?
Yes, yes, they exist.
How many?
There's somewhere between 3% and 5% in major universities. It's actually a reasonable population of them, because for most of them, the environment is such a difficult environment and often hostile to the Christian faith. Many of them live in a foxhole. So so my job, first of all, is to just walk around campus department by department and find them and meet
them. Who lets you do that?
Oh, the university does. I'd eventually get a campus ID and other things like that and become a part of the institution as far as, you know, being there long term.
So how do you find these people? I mean, you're walking around the campus. Mm-hmm. Are you knocking on doors, talking to people you already know?
Yeah, usually I'll start with a few people that I already know. Like, for instance, when I started the ministry at Georgia Tech back in 1995, we had a list of probably 8 or 10 faculty and staff that had at some time either been on a mailing list or had gone to a conference or something that Faculty Commons had sponsored. So we had identified a few people over the years, but nobody had ever had any personal contact with them. So I would go on campus and I would meet them and I'd talk about who I am and what we would like to do on campus, help them to be a more effective ambassador for Christ. And then over time, as I get to know them, I said, well, do you know of other people on campus who are Christians? And they usually know one or two, but they don't realize that there's not just one or two. There's probably on a campus that size, 80 of them.
Okay, I'm still stuck back at Commons. Faculty Commons.
Yes.
Why did you choose that name? What does that mean?
I didn't choose the name. It was some of the leadership of the ministry. But what that is especially like Ivy League campuses at Princeton and Harvard and Yale, places like that. There's actually a room that is the commons, the common room for faculty, mm-hmm. Where they hang out after hours, where they have lunches together, where they have special events together. It's the place where professors socialize and talk together as colleagues.
And you went in to this commons area?
No. Most campuses don't really have them. It's the name is more a metaphor than anything else.
Okay.
There are some campuses that do, some of the older universities. It's kind of a throwback to the old English system.
Okay. Like the teacher's lounge.
Yes, it's sort of like the teacher's lounge.
The doctor's lounge or
yes,
whatever.
The doctor's lounge,
okay.
Yes.
So you were doing programs that were born out of the Faculty Commons. What were those programs? What did they consist of?
Oh, we do a lot of different things. Of course, I would meet with professors one-on-one and coach and mentor them. But we would also, over time, as I identified a sufficient number of them, we would organize as a group on campus. At Georgia Tech, we called ourselves the Christian Faculty Forum. And we would have meetings every week. They now meet every month. But while I was working there, we would meet every week where we would do a variety of different things. Sometimes it was very ministry-oriented, you know, in terms of equipping them to share their testimony and communicate their faith creatively with their students and their coworkers. Other times we'd have book reviews, academic papers, and other things that are more intellectual and academic-oriented, more like a research group of sorts. How do you bring Christian scholarship into your teaching and research? So there's the ministry side, and then there's the academic side. You know, you are a teacher, you're a professor at a major university. Does your faith have anything to do with what you do professionally? And so trying to help them pursue both of those goals.
And you and I would imagine anybody listening to us now, we know that our faith or our lack of faith influences everything we do.
Of course.
Whether we are a janitor, a teacher, whatever, we are affected by our faith or lack thereof. Now, I can tell already, one, I love your voice. Two, I'm thinking that you don't just tell people what to think, that you're really good at conversation, and I'm seeing that we could stretch this out for 3 hours, and we only have 20 or 30 minutes.
Of course.
So, let me get back to the thing that intrigued me the most. Where did you get the title Transparent for this new book that you've just written?
Well, it is a God thing. It really is. I'd been working on this book for the better part of 5 years, and it did not have a title. I didn't know what to call it. It was the untitled book on the power of assumptions. It's about as close as I could get. And just asking God, because I had a deadline. Once I had a publisher and we were starting to move forward on it, so in order to make certain wholesale catalogs, I had a deadline to have a title and a cover done. So it can make the catalog. And I was literally 4 days before the deadline. Not only did I not have a title, I didn't have a cover either, because you can't do a cover without a title. And I'd been asking God, please, what do I do? And nothing was satisfying. And literally, as I was laying my head down on the pillow at 1:30 in the morning after watching the national college football championship game, I turned out the lights, my head hit the pillow, and the voice in my head says, Transparent. how to see through the powerful assumptions that control you. I'm just thinking that's what assumptions allows you to do, is to see through things. And so the things that don't seem clear, seem complex, that makes them transparent.
You said that's what assumptions allow you to do?
Yes.
Is to see through things.
Yes.
See, I'm sitting here having trouble connecting, being transparent, and just assuming something.
Sure.
So take me into your mind.
Sure. Well, what motivated me to pursue this in the first place was my work with professors, because I would see a lot of success over time getting professors to talk about their faith with their students and their coworkers. And they'll do it in their office, they'll do it over meals, they'll hold outreach events, other things like that. But when they go in the classroom and they do the thing that they're a leader or an expert at, I would ask them, how does God inform what you do? How does he contribute to knowledge in such a way that you do something different than the rest of your colleagues? Because the fact of the matter is, even though there are many, many Christian professors in major universities, when it comes to doing their job, they teach the same course the same way as the atheists do. And I ask them, well, how does God affect that? How does God inform that? How does God contribute to knowledge in such a way that you teach differently? And they say, well, I can talk about God or not talk about God. I don't really see that it makes that much difference, because it's just 18 weeks of calculus. Or what does God have to do with a chemical equation? It's not that I'm not interested. I just don't understand what you're asking me. And before long, I began to realize they just really don't have any background to the tools to make the connections. And short of expecting them to go get a postgraduate degree in the philosophy of religion or something, which none of them are going to do, they just do the only thing they know. It's what they learned in grad school. And so nothing changes. And I'm trying to find a way to make it simple and straight to the point. What is the bottom line that will help make that connection? I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who started our faculty ministry back at the beginning, and later went on to found what is now known as the King's College in New York City. And he'd been wrestling over the same problem, and he threw a suggestion at me about 6 years ago. He said, I think that the way to expose the soft underbelly of the university, to get at the ideas and where they're weak, where they're flawed, is at the level of their assumptions, because they're making up stuff and they won't tell you. That in fact, the assumptions that they're proceeding from aren't true, they don't work, they don't correspond to anything as real, and they won't admit it. He said, if you can figure out how those assumptions work, not only would we be able to expose the false ideas in the university, we'd actually be able to make a connection and establish a beachhead for Christian scholarship unlike anything that's been done in many, many years.
Are you listening? He's talking university life. I am all over the place with this. I mean, my mind is just jumping in 1,000 directions. I'm thinking couples. I'm thinking families.
Yes.
I'm thinking businesses and organizations. All these assumptions we all make.
Yes.
And how many of them are ever accurate?
So as I began working on this, my motivation was trying to help professors. But I discovered very quickly that what I had developed was way beyond the university, that this helps families, this helps students, this helps business leaders connect their faith to their business. It enables them to find God and engage with him in their public life. There's so many things out there for Christians in their private lives, but how does your faith actually have anything to do with what you do on a day-to-day basis? And I figured out how to make the connections for professors, and that same way of making the connections works for any adult. But the cool thing is it also provides a basic critical thinking skill that a parent can teach to their students, or a pastor can teach to the students that they work with, so that they can figure out the messages that they encounter every day, whether it's in a classroom.
Can a mom teach it to a five-year-old?
Not quite to a five-year-old, but a middle schooler, yes. We will eventually develop this to the point where we will be able to do that with a five-year-old, because that's where it all starts. In fact, I have a curriculum expert who is going to be working with me in this next year to develop that very thing.
Okay. I don't even know where I'm about to take this, but I'm very intrigued. And I wish it were a five-year-old instead of a middle schooler. And I'm trying to decide if I want to role play as a middle schooler or as a college professor. And are you willing to do some role play
sure.
with me right now?
Sure.
Okay. I think I'm going to be the teacher.
Okay.
And I've just met you. And we were at Chick-fil-A, and we were sitting in a booth next door, and you heard my conversation, and you picked up on the fact that I'm a college professor, and then you jumped in, and we're chatting away, and you asking me, do I share my faith? And I say, good gracious, no, Dave. Are you serious? In today's world, I know better. I'm working towards tenure.
Sure.
You really want to get me fired?
Well, with tenured faculty, we'll go a little easier until they jump through that hoop. But I can equip them with the basic skills that will allow them to have a substantial ministry by doing their job.
Let's role play.
Sure. Okay.
I'm the professor.
All right.
Dave, I can't do that. You're telling me I should share Christ in the college where I'm teaching?
Yes.
Do you really want me? No, I can't do it.
Well, actually, there are ways that you can.
How?
Well, the way that you do it is not whipping out your Bible or a Four Spiritual Laws booklet or something or other like that. But what you do...
But that's all I've ever been taught.
Oh, of course. Because most Christians don't understand how to engage in the academic world. I do. I have 2 postgraduate degrees, one of them from Oxford University, and I know how to this world works because I've worked in it for over 20 years. I know your world.
All right, Jesus matters to me.
Yes.
My faith matters to me. I would love to share it, but I also want my job.
Sure. I've developed a specific tool and technique that you can use that will allow you to teach more truth that's based in God and the Bible, but does not quote chapter and verse. It'll allow you to teach a specific critical thinking skill to your students, because a stated educational outcome that every academic institution has from middle school on up is to develop critical thinking leaders that live in a global society in the 21st century. I can teach you a systematic way to show your students how to think, but not what to think. And at the same time, as you do it, you will have a ministry in your classroom by teaching the power of assumptions.
Do I have to read this whole book to get it?
You don't have to read the whole book, but there are sections of it that would be very useful. There, understanding what my critical assumptions test is that allows you to detect the assumptions in your own course.
Is the test in the book?
Yes. It's on page 36 of the book.
Is there a website?
There is an app.
An app?
For your phone, yes.
Oh, no, you're kidding me.
No, it's that practical.
How long would it take me to do the test?
20 seconds.
Oh, good heavens. Give me the test. Can you give me the test?
Of course. Let's look at a specific thing. I don't know whether you can picture in your mind something in your course, or let's just say something from a TV show, a scene in a movie, or something out of a website, or a lecture you've heard, or a conversation on talk radio. Okay. So let's start. Is it something that you read? Is it something you watched? Or is it something you heard?
Okay, I'm thinking about a post on Facebook.
Okay, so it's something you read.
Yeah.
Okay, does the thing that you were reading, does it have anything to do with people? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, so if it has something to do with people, there are 4 questions that topic will be about. It'll be about, was the article talking about what is a human being?
Yes.
Were they talking about where does knowledge begin? It probably wasn't the topic.
Where does life begin?
Yeah, but it probably wasn't talking about where knowledge begins. Was it talking about what is good?
Yes.
Was it talking about what humanity's basic problem is?
Maybe in a, disrespect for life. Yeah, okay.
So which one of those 4 questions was the topic primarily about? Was it about primarily what is good? Or was it primarily about what is a human being?
Probably primarily about what is a human being.
Okay. Well, if it's primarily about what a human being is, there's 3 different ways that people tend to answer that question based on the way they assume. The first one is, a human being is nothing more than a highly evolved animal. The second one, a human being is an evolving expression of a spiritual or a socio-political ideal, the ideal human or the ideal human society. Or the third way is that a human being is a free steward created to reflect who God is. How were they answering that question in that Facebook post?
Oh, mama. It was about abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular post made reference to Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, where Jeremiah is mentioning that God has said to him, you were a prophet, I knew you when you were bones in your mother's womb. And this post seemed to indicate that there should never, ever be an abortion because of that.
Yes.
And in my most recent years, probably all my life, I have mostly agreed with that. And yet the debate, and so much that I'm seeing on Facebook now, is calling this subject up in a way that has us fighting and hating one another.
Yes.
And it's just horrible. Well, I've been remembering my years as a nurse, and I've been remembering the first baby I saw born as in nurses in
sure.
training. It was born without a head. It was called anencephalic.
Oh, yes.
And that mother had suffered. She knew it. I know of other cases where babies have had to be aborted, and literally surgically aborted, in some cases broken up and pulled out, sometimes because of the mother's health, and sometimes because she and the doctor recognized certain things that made them think the baby would not be viable if it was taken full term.
Yes.
So all these things have been going on in my mind, and many of my assumptions in recent days are getting shattered.
Sure.
I don't know how I feel right now. I can't allow myself. For instance, I also know, well, as a nurse and just being somebody everybody talks to, I've heard so many stories. I heard one story of a woman whose baby was deemed not to be viable.
Yes.
And this particular woman was a severe diabetic, and the doctor was very worried about what it was going to do to her health long term if she carried the baby to term. They induced labor, and the baby, of course, died within minutes after birth. To this day, she takes flowers to the grave of that child.
Yes.
And grieves over it. And when we are having these conversations, Dave, we are stabbing moms who were not to be, moms who are, moms to be. We are stabbing them in the heart. We don't know where they're coming from.
Sure.
So I am torn right now. And actually, I was sitting out in my car praying about this before I ever came in with you, because I didn't want this to get in the way of our conversation.
Of course.
And yet, how do you escape it? This is real on college campuses. There are clinics there where kids go and get birth control, and they sign up for abortions.
Sure.
So this is very real. Is this a subject that you've ever discussed with faculty?
Oh, I mean, it comes up from time to time. And you know, what you're talking about here is really the question, what is good? And
see, I misread that. I would have thought it was, what is human life?
Well,
but it's both.
Yeah, it is. It's both. You're talking about, what is a human being, first of all, because if it's nothing more than a highly evolved animal, well, you know, then terminating a pregnancy is no big deal. And likewise, if we're nothing more than an evolving expression of some spiritual or sociopolitical ideal, again, it doesn't really matter whether we abort it. But if a human being is a free steward created to reflect who God is, then none of us are an accident. Even if our parents didn't intend us, God intended us. Nobody snuck into this creation without him knowing about it. He deliberately chose to make every one of us, even one who was born without a brain. He chose to make every one of them. And so there is that consideration to consider, that that every human being is a custom creation of God as he chose to make them. But then there's the question, what do you do about that? And that is the question, what is good? There's three different ways that people answer that question based off of their core assumption also.
Okay.
And the one way that people answer the question, what is good? And I'm not talking about what is your ethical theory. I'm just saying, when you use the word good, what do you mean by that?
And you're using good, not right or
yes.
correct. You're saying, what is good?
What is good?
Okay.
Yes, because right is a reflection of what you understand good to be.
Okay.
Good, if you start with one set of assumptions, good is whatever I decide it is. I'm my own standard, or we are our own standard, so good is just whatever we decide. The second way of assuming would say that good is whatever will achieve the ideal. And
ooh,
and sometimes
the ideal,
yeah,
whatever will achieve the ideal.
Yes.
Wow.
The ideal as in the spiritual ideal or the sociopolitical ideal.
Oh, my.
Whatever will help us perfect humanity and make us a better society.
Which that, is where we are right now in America.
Discussion. Yeah, most people think that ideals are real, and if they are and that human beings can be perfected, then whatever will help us achieve that ideal human and ideal human society, we will do it.
So what's the third one?
And the third one is good is who God is in his person and his character. Psalm 119:68 says, the Lord is good and does good. So who God is and what he does is the literal definition of the word good. So that when we were wondering what makes something good, it's who God is in his person and his character. And we as human beings are designed to reflect him. What is a human being? A free steward created to reflect who God is. And so if we understand who God is, then we understand ourselves and the world around us better. But if we don't know who God is, then we don't understand ourselves and the world around us very well. And especially because we're designed to reflect him. It's like there's an original and then there's a mirror. The image is not the original. The original is God, and we're designed to reflect who he is. So when we ask, what is good? Good is who God is, and everybody can know that. That's why Christians will say that there is something that is good for everybody, and there's things that are wrong for everybody, because whatever is good is what reflects who God is, and whatever doesn't reflect who God is, that's what bad is, and we all know it. Even the atheist knows that.
Oh, this is awful. Our time is almost, we got 2 minutes. What happens? I'm still in the room with the doctor and the patient here.
Sure.
What happens in that room, in that discussion? Suppose the doctor is a Christian, and yet his concern is for the life of his patient.
Sure.
You would go in just like you would with the professor and teach him this same technique?
Well, sure, so that he understands what a human being is and why human life is so valuable. But at the same time, how do you decide what's right and what's wrong? It's according to your understanding
and
of what good is.
How does he decide whose life is more important,
well,
the mother's or the baby's?
That's a difficult thing to ask. And if it means that the mother will die, you probably may need to abort the baby. But if there's any way that you can save both, of course you would want to do that. But you know,
I know of a case. In fact, I recommend a book written, well, I'm not going to call names, but he did write a book about the experience. A man whose wife and child died because the doctor said, I've got to choose. And if he had chosen in one direction, one of them would have lived.
Yes.
But the husband said, no, choose in this direction. And he both lost.
Sure.
And these kinds of decisions are often made split second.
Yes.
And both that mother and that baby died. And this was a man of God.
Sure.
Who actually walked away from the church for a while, where he pastored, in order to explore these questions.
When it comes to abortion, though, this is a very small number of the total abortions that are performed every year. Cases like what you're talking about, and I don't deny that there are heart-wrenching situations.
And I agree with you absolutely.
I mean,
yet that's what's being thrown at us in the media right now.
Yes,
and it's horrific.
Yes,
and we're listening to sound bites, and we're not thinking about our own histories, our own walk with God, our own wrong or right assumptions.
Sure.
And nothing is transparent to us.
Well, why is it that people say, I can't tell somebody what they ought to do? I can't tell them what's right and what's wrong. It's because they decide for themselves what's right and what's good. Well, that is not a Christian way of thinking. And we as Christians articulate that. I can't tell them what to think. I can't tell them what to do, because they decide for themselves. They've bought the world's way of thinking.
But if we care enough, we can help teach others how to think.
Yes, and they can figure things out for themselves.
Wow. Dave, our time is up. Give me another website again if people want to follow up with you. Give
sure.
it to me.
TheTransparentBook.com. TheTransparentBook.com. It's the website for the book. You can get the book. You can get the ebook. You can get the app. All from the website.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me here at Reach to Touch.
Thank you, MJ. I appreciate it.
Lord, I must stand against the mess. Knowing in my weakness, you will be made strong.
Thanks again for joining us here at Reach to Touch. Brought to you in part by ChuckHancock.com. The Jesse Lee Jones Story. And MaryJaneHolt.com. Please look around you, because most likely within your reach are those for whom you can make a difference today if you reach to touch.
I will touch the ones you place within me.
HLERadio.com, Jennings, Louisiana.